recording.
First and foremost, thank you all for being here. We have a small, intimate group, but a great group nonetheless. So I appreciate all the board members and all the principals and staff and attendees who are here. As we normally do, we start off by walking ourselves through the mission and the values, which I'll take responsibility for today. So just to reiterate, our mission: to reimagine public education in low-income communities of color, to prepare conscious, critical thinkers who are equipped to graduate from college and create a more equitable and sustainable world. Values: the first is justice. We examine bias, racism, and prejudice. We deliver culturally responsive curricula. We succeed when students' race and class cease to predict their level of achievement. Community: we care, we collaborate, we respect the rights and voices of our stakeholders. Curiosity: we question, we explore, we innovate. Sustainability: we think globally and act locally. We adapt. We encourage systems thinking to create a sustainable future. And finally, leadership: we listen, we think critically, we advocate, we shift public discourse, we are our own superheroes. With that, if we can ensure that we record attendance, do we have the sheet that is going around?
Yes, they're going out now.
Fantastic. I will call the meeting to order, and if I can get a motion to approve the agenda.
I will move to approve the agenda.
Do I have a second?
I second the motion.
Okay.
Dina, I.
Cam, I.
Janina, I.
Anthony, I. The agenda has been approved. I now will move it to Parnas for the opener.
Excellent. So we're going to ask everyone to stand up and go talk to someone that you don't normally talk to. This is going to be a quick one, but similarly aligned with our last. So go to someone you don't normally go to.
We're all going over there.
Hi.
How are you?
Hello.
Hello. Whoa, what's
going on? I'm here for the district.
Oh, fantastic.
What brings you here?
They have a board of meeting trees on here.
Are you here for us?
Yeah.
I didn't know that you were going to come. That's awesome.
Yeah, man. I even went to ECA Chills, can you believe it?
Allison,
of course.
For our opener, I'm going to beg you guys to talk with someone who you don't normally talk to about strategic planning. When have you seen it done really well, and when have you seen it done really poorly? What are some things you would want ECS to learn from the process? Because our conversation is going to be about strategic planning. So if you can, take a minute. To each share when you've seen it done well and poorly and what you'd want us to learn from it, and then we're going to share back around when we come back together. Everyone won't have to share, but we would like some people to share.
Yeah.
Thank you.
How are you? It's good to see you. It's been so long.
So thank you for all of your help.
No problem.
Thank you.
So we have time for a question. When it's done well.
I mean, in one sense, I think it's like the saying, you know, that plans are worthless, but your plan is everything. The plans, you know, they always end up being totally different from what you set out to do, but it's the process of going through it and thinking about it.
I find that
you
you have to have a diverse thing. You have a lot of visionaries that think big. Mm-hmm. You know, the devil's in the details. I think visionaries tend to not want to get lost in the weeds. So sometimes you need someone to go into the weeds. And I think when you can have that person that can say, did you think about parking? Did you think, well, wait a minute, you know it's going to be 100 degrees out there. You know? And you're like, oh, wow, we didn't think of that.
Strengths, the weaknesses,
and then
there's like chapters in every city between here and New York and across the city. But because we all are following the exact thing, we just all agree on the same thing. We have to see where we're at and commit to that for the rest of our lives. And we use on the radio how successful it is. Whereas the other stories are trying to acquire and it works all the time.
Everybody knows what it is.
And I think part of that is just
like it's part of the mantra.
Yeah.
So that we're all focused
yes.
on it.
I
all
think
the
we're
and in
the population.
It's very important to have a begin with the end of that. What is the
their format
stakeholders. The opposite of everything we said. It's not a living document. You put up on a shelf, it's finished and it's done, and you know, in 5 years, we'll do it again.
I'm so excited that he's here.
I think it's cool. I find it doesn't work with personal leaders, because even though I say you want the person, there has to be a leader, because at some point, you're going to get stuck, or you're going to have difference with people, and there has to be someone that's willing to say, you know what, I respect everyone's decision, but we have to move in these directions. You know, come see me later if you have any, but you know, because it needs to keep going, and I think you cannot rule by committee. I think it's a great concept, but at some point, someone has to. So it sounds like it's a balance of everything. You know, you want it big, but you don't want it something too big. You want something simple, but you don't want it so simple that.
It has to also have some agreement. Like you can't have this group go off and do it, and then have someone else. Oh, now you're gonna go run it. Go run this. And it says you're gonna make 10 schools.
God.
Did you hire me for this?
So, can you show me on your hand how much more time you need?
And I think
excellent. So let's come back together. We're actually just going to stay standing so that we're not in separate areas. Do you guys want to come here, Ken, on this side? Okay, so if you can somebody volunteer to share things that they talked about?
Well, I want to share that I'm part of a new organization that is doing strategic planning now. And it's very frustrating when I'm not accustomed to.
Waiting too long is bad. What other takeaways did you guys have? Let's start with what works really well. What should we make sure we do?
Also, from my experience, and then actually I think it was this year, first and foremost, leadership, ensuring that the organization and the people in the organization have unity and purpose. And once you have unity of purpose and the right people on the bus, ensuring that there's a common language so that when you do sit down and do strategic planning, that everyone understands the process, everyone understands, you know, how the process works with the communication and education piece that leads up to the strategic planning, effective strategic planning.
Ken, do you want to share?
Well, in addition to what's been said, I think that, you know, really having a clear alignment around the vision, the why, you know, beginning with the end in mind, where is it that we all want to end up here, and having real agreement and alignment on that.
If you talk a little bit about wherever we want to go, to have like small goals that are possibly attainable instead of having broad general goals, and so to be more specific as to what the goal is, so then we know we've reached whatever we want to achieve towards the bigger goal.
Does anybody want to share things that we should be careful not to do in this process?
Not to delegate it to a small committee to just do it and release to everybody else. It needs to be inclusive.
You reference regeneration. Mm-hmm. We talked about it being a living document that is constantly edited and changed as it needs to be.
We also talked about diversity of thought partners in the process of creating it.
Thank you, guys. As we head into this process, if we can keep those ideas in mind. Thank you.
Okay, we're moving on to, if you're following along on the agenda, we're moving on to reports and presentations, and so we will now invite our principals for updates. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed. First, are there any presentations from the floor on non-agenda items? Okay, are there any presentations from the floor on agenda items?
Did we approve the agenda?
We did. So now we can move on to the reports and presentations.
Yes.
And we will have our principals provide updates. So I invite the principals to provide their updates. I think we're doing ECHS first.
I believe so. I hope so.
Otherwise, you're standing there for no reason.
For some
Yeah. My name is Dave Trevel. I have the distinct pleasure and privilege of being the principal in residence at Environmental Charter High School while Casey's on her parental leave, bonding with her beautiful baby. We're starting off on 19. The first update I'd like to give is, I think, a common theme when we update regarding Environmental Charter High School in Lawndale is support and celebrating our counseling team headed by Lucy Vendonos, Assistant Principal of Student Services. They have, I hope it gets on the screen for folks that are not here.
I'm so sorry. Am I supposed to be sharing my screen, Jeremiah?
Yes.
I truly apologize that I did not do that.
Yeah, we have
Apple
technology.
Apple TV, I can share mine if you'd like.
That would be great if you could. So that gives me a moment to unshare mine. And
is there something that we can call up ourselves here?
And while this is happening and we're getting technology up to date, we have a special guest from the Lawndale Elementary School District with us tonight. He is a return visitor or board member, and that is Jorge Aguirre.
Hello.
So, So this is, and Dave introduced himself a little bit, but you've met already?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Whatever. All right, so then we bring
this. I came late because I actually went to ECA Cash. Yeah, I know.
And do you remember Lauren?
Ken, were you guys able to see it on there? Do you want me to turn that TV so you guys can see it there?
Yeah, maybe. Or also, is there something
yeah,
you can...
I can
I'm sharing it right this second.
Yeah. How do I get shared?
Are you on Zoom?
I just on the board.
Okay.
Sorry.
The link should be on there as well. If you were trying to link under board,
there you go.
ECS board presentation. ECS.
There's a ECS I presentation. Yes, not the other.
By the way, Jorge is the one who introduced me to ECS.
Yeah.
So,
he's my recruit.
Thank Jorge for my, or don't thank him.
Before I left, I brought my replacement. Oh. No, I just, that was coincidental.
Thank you for that.
Are we good tech-wise?
Yeah.
Okay. So going back to praising our counselors. It's one thing that I said at the Inglewood board meeting last night, and I'll say it any chance I get. If one thing can get stolen from ECHS, open source, and shared across every high school in the country that would make this country better is our approach to counseling students into college. They're amazing. It's not even winter break yet, and out of 124 seniors, 120 have already completed FAFSA and or DREAM Act applications and vetted by counselors. We only have four left, and those are extenuating circumstances, and even those are being addressed. But before winter break, that's remarkable. And so they deserve a lot of credit for that. The next slide I want to share about is, we unfortunately lost another member of the ECHS community recently. He was playing soccer on a club team. That is coached by the coach that coaches our ECHS team. We still don't know the cause of death, and we're awaiting an autopsy, and then the family will share results with us, and they'll let us know what they're comfortable with us sharing, what segments of stakeholders. The reason that I want to share this, not just because it's important for the board to know, but because this isn't the first student to pass in 2019. It's not even the first student from the soccer team to pass in 2019. What Casey, Jane, and Lucy put into play or into action in February, responding to the passing, the first passing of a student at ECHS, is a systematic, comprehensive, and like, I don't want to say sustainable, but like equitable sharing of the emotional labor that comes with working at a school like ours, and a student passing away. From the moment that Lucy, Jane, and I got on a call on the Sunday that we found out, to the phone banking and the phone trees and making those phone calls, to prepping our staff with a meeting the morning of, and getting supports in and leaning in on partners, including Jorge Arroyo. We owe a lot of gratitude for what Lawndale did recently. They came in and with less than 24 hours notice provided so much support. And it was really one of those things that makes us feel like we're working with the district, not working against or without them. And so we felt a lot of support. But I wanted to share this because it's something that we should probably share a cabinet in the future before we ever need it and hopefully never need it, but it's something to learn from so you're not grasping at straws of how to respond to trauma and tragedy. The boys put together some healing processes, went through some healing processes with some of Lawndale's therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists, including making a mural to him and a dedication to him where they hang out. That picture is from that day. They also played their first soccer game the Tuesday after he passed away in dedication to him. And we put together a bus. We got a bus and we bused kids over. His family was there.
Did
the family was very grateful, and it turned into a eulogy, a wake of sort, and an opportunity for them and our students to speak about his impact that will be long, long felt there. School feels a little different this week than it did that week, but when you look at the success of a school community and what you build, there are the test results, and we'll talk about all that, and then there's this, which is real life, and that superseded everything and made it much more real. And as my time at ECHS gets shorter and shorter and move on to my next journey within Environmental Charter Schools, you should all be very proud of the team at Environmental Charter High School and the community and capacity that was built long before I was ever there and will be there long after my services at a different school. So switching over to something much more school related in terms of everyday testing. Interim assessment blocks, otherwise known as IABs. If you work in the world of schools in California, you're going to hear IAB, IAB, IAB. And so we're hoping to kind of teach you a little bit about what it is. An interim assessment block takes a segment of the CASP or the SBAC and allows you to test only that specific section. There's an ICA, which would allow you to replicate the entire test if you wanted to. When you don't want to replicate the entire test and you want to replicate a specific section so you can get feedback on that so you can respond to it and have enough time within the school year to respond to it, then you do an interim assessment block. What we decided as an organization this year is that everyone in grades 6 through 11 would take the informational text IAB. It allows, if you remember, like nothing else, it's the students and teachers can test drive the interface and experience the rigor. What we've experienced in the past is that sometimes the interface, it's the opposite of innovative or intuitive. I mean, it's clunky, it's difficult to navigate, it's not like designed by Apple engineers, and then the level of rigor and what they ask is sometimes jarring to students and to teachers. So we wanted everyone to experience it early enough in the year, that especially at the high school, that the ownership of student performance and student outcomes on this state test was not only at the 11th grade level. In middle school, from third grade to eighth grade, you take it every year, math and ELA. Once you get to high school, you don't take it until 11th grade. And so if you don't share that burden of ownership with all grade levels and all staff, then it really, like, it becomes a non-desirable job to be an 11th grade teacher because you're under all this scrutiny without everyone else sharing that ownership. So we wanted everyone from 9th grade teachers up until 12th grade teachers to experience that rigor, and we wanted to be able to respond to it and pull that data back. So if we go to the next slide.
Is this a state-administered like practice test?
It is a state-administered practice test, okay. That we can get immediate feedback on. Some of it is hand-scored, mm-hmm. and some of it is automatically scored if it's a multiple-choice assessment, but there are parts in which the state will provide a rubric for you to calibrate with your staff, and then you can hand score. Cool. So we did what we did this year in terms of teacher rollout. We went back to like the why. What is the purpose of an IAB and how can we use it? And we calibrated that because we wanted to make sure that we weren't making assumptions. And then the teachers became the students, and they took an actual IAB, which was eye-opening for a lot of people, to see what it is that our 11th graders are expected to not only be able to know, but be able to navigate. In terms of the format that is provided. And then we calibrated and normed the rubric, so we, our teachers and staff acted as not only the students, but also as the state assessment readers that grade, so we can get that full experience. All staff graded the open response, and then we did data analysis in grade level teams and in departments, so we know what math needs, what ELA needs vertically aligned, and as well as what are the trends across the grade levels. As we look at these results, it's important to know that these standards being assessed are 11th grade standards primarily. And so even though 9th graders and 10th graders took it, it's the 11th grade test, because there is no 9th grade test or 10th grade test from the state. And on the next slide, what you see is kind of like a RIT score. There's a standard cut score of 2583, which means that if you get that overall score on CASP, you have met standard. you'll see our ninth grade average. If you average all their scores, they're 2604. Now, that doesn't mean that they would actually all, that they would achieve mastery. What it means, or meet standards, what it means is that based on the algorithm they show that they have and how they did on this one section, the state is projecting that they will likely get 2604. There's a variety of things. A student could be way better at informational text than narrative. So there's a variety of things that take that into account. But you can see that 9th and 10th grade is not in bad shape for being over a year away from taking it.
Can I ask a goofy question?
That's the only type of question I'll take.
Near standard, not like met standard. Why is it near standard?
I'm glad you asked that. So when you take the actual SBAC, you get four designations. You get above standard, met standard, approaching standard, and below standard. When you take the IAB, because it's only a specific section, the standard deviation is so large that they put you at near standard, even if you're above, if you just barely met it, because the standard deviation means that you could also fall into right below it. So this is like the what is often referred to as the bubble proficiency students, where you want to make sure that you pay attention to that so you can move them up and they don't fall below. There's just not enough data within an IAB to properly project proficiency. Our 10th graders did better than our 11th graders, actually. And that's, like, anecdotally speaking, that's not a surprise, because last year as 9th graders, they were rock stars. On the next slide, you can see the 11th grade. There's a big chunk here at near standard that we want to move up there so we can maintain our progress on performance testing. And then we were even able to look at performance by assessment answer and item type. The more rigorous an item was, the worse the student did across all three schools, actually. So what we found is that if there's one answer, our students did really well on that. If there was an answer that getting that answer right then led to you getting the rest of the answers right within a section, our students did worse on that. If there was multiple answers within one, and it doesn't tell you select three, but select multiple, select as many, then it gets a little more difficult when it's not, the answer doesn't seem binary. So what we took out based on that, and this is our last slide, is there's two things that stood out for us. The format of the assessment, we need to remove that as a barrier, because when students are facing multiple assessment items that have multiple answers and open-ended answers for the first time on this clunky interface, then it's like taking your driver's license test on a car you haven't been practicing in. So we want to make sure that we're removing the format as a barrier, and that teachers see it with their first hand, aren't just reading about it, but are seeing it. So these are all the shift that our teachers have come up with. They want to do more digital assessments that have more multiple answers. Our ELD coordinator is piloting a platform for digital annotations. We've talked about reading apprenticeship here before, where students talk to the text, they do purposeful metacognitive annotations, but doing it on paper is different than doing it on the screen. So we want to make sure that they can transfer the skills that they do on paper onto a screen with enough time to practice getting good at it before they actually have to do it in a test environment. In terms of content, we have different responses by grade level. Our 9th grade students require more reading stamina, because although they did really well, there was a lot of complaining about, oh, this is too long and my eyes hurt. So we're realizing that as much as we want to close computer screens, we also need to do some longer extended reading time on computers for them to build that stamina as the years go on. 10th grade students are in a good place relative to their grade, but they're working this year primarily on narrative units. So we want to identify, the 10th grade team is working on identifying what skills are in informational text that can be applied to narrative text as an access point for setting them up for success so they feel like they're great at it already. And in 11th grade, we're focusing on rigorous assessment items from the time that we took this through CASP, making sure that by the time they get to that state test, they're just so accustomed to difficult assessment items that are multiple formats. And in our 12th grade, we recognize that in order to be able to support our students or our seniors that are completing their thesis completion, that's our senior thesis that's dependent on scientific text as evidence, that we're going to need to be able to support them, because the scientific text is one of the more difficult tests to tackle for 12th graders, for really any grade. And then we're going to repeat this for math in the early spring so we can get some actionable data there. But it's our first year of piloting something across the entire organization and across all grade levels. So sometimes it feels wonderful, sometimes it feels like we're stumbling through, but we're definitely increasing that shared ownership. It is really difficult in our experience at the high school to get the entire staff to buy in if they haven't gone through such a comprehensive approach. If you've only been teaching ninth grade for 2 years in your career, an 11th grade test doesn't mean as much to you. So to be able to begin this process now allows us to lay the foundation for a school that truly shares the burden of student outcomes. And then we can share the burden of the celebrations. We have a couple of students that have already gotten early admissions acceptance, one to Mills and one today. Well, if you've been at the campus, Philip, he's probably given you a tour. Just got early admission today at 4 p.m. to Columbia. Woo-hoo! So that's our W for the week. Any questions?
Yeah, is this something you can repeat as often as you want? Or
so you can. The state has not built up yet a robust bank that you can take multiple informational texts once throughout the year. They only really have one. And I think part of it is that they don't want to generate just a test email where you use it over and over and over. They want you to take that information purposefully and then apply it. Although schools are pushing back and they want, just give us a robust bank. If this is going to be like the measuring stick, and give it to us, and let us play with it. But it's still relatively new to the state. They do have a digital library that is attached to each of the sections of an IAB, and they will give you like sample lessons and readings that you could do for your students at near standard, your students at below standards, and your students that are above standard. They'll give you things that if you go in there and you go on a deep dive, you really could leverage a lot of support that the state provides.
Right. I just want to be clear. So the 9th graders and 10th graders and 11th graders are all taking the exact same test?
For practice. In the spring, the only ones being tested are 11th graders across the state.
So by the time these 9th graders get to 11th grade, they've done this test how many times now? Like twice a year?
Once for ELA and once for math.
Right.
Yeah.
So they've done it four times before they even
started 11th grade.
11th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Is that standard practice out of the school?
Lauren will kind of talk about it in a bit. Some schools, teachers use an IAB as their unit exam, but no one else in their department is using it. So they're on an island. In other schools, they'll do it. They'll overuse it, and they'll end up being data-rich and information-poor because they never have the time to actually analyze and plan next steps, because they're too busy testing. Which school uses an IAB the best? I don't know. If you point me in the direction or you find that answer before I do, let me know and we'll go visit and steal some ideas.
This is more than we've done in previous years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we've decided to cut out one of the NWEA tests.
Yes.
So this is
What? What is the, it appears that the numbers here correlate to the numbers that are now on this dashboard.
Yes, under IAB
right.
For October.
What is the prediction, if there is one? Do we know what that prediction is?
That's what's complicated, so both Robert and Danielle spend some time with me talking through that stuff. We know that the ones who are above standard are exceeding standard. The ones that are near standard, the way some people look at it, they say, well, 50% are likely to be meeting and exceeding, and the other 50% might not be. So,
it's this one that we talked about. That falls in between. The challenge, Allison, is because we're not doing the entire comprehensive assessment, we're doing one section.
Right.
The standard deviation is so large that it's difficult to predict. What we can predict is that they're going to be in that range.
They're going to be close.
And if you remember our what we said earlier in the year, we targeted students last year specifically that were on that bubble and that were showing growth in CASP. We'd like to do something similar to be able to help those students.
Okay.
Any other questions?
So this gives you guys valuable information. So if we know that the kids are not getting question 13 and they're having problems with, I don't know, grammatical rules or something like that, then the teachers are going back and working on that and changing their...
So they're not going back to like a specific question and analyzing it in terms of like whole group instruction. It's not, if we do that, our teachers will push back in terms of teaching to the test. They want that creativity. What they're seeing is, what was that question testing? What was that question assessing? And in what format? So that we can take the content that we value that is social justice based, and then when we assess it in that similar manner. Of the ones that were, yeah.
What we found when we analyzed the test whole group is that the skills themselves, they really require critical thinking from students. Mm-hmm. So I think in the analysis whole group, we got more buy-in, and teachers were more on board for mimicking their in-class assessments to this level of rigor, because it wasn't just regurgitation of facts. The items really require students to integrate information from lots of different sources and analyze things in a really high level. So they do mimic the test, but it's in the habits and the skills that it requires.
We can't predict the relevancy or the how much they're going to enjoy the reading they're getting,
right.
Or whether or not they'll have any actual schema that relates to that. And there's a lot of like social justice work in terms of like and advocacy of what's getting put on the test, because when you put something like skiing on there, and a kid is, what is skiing? Then all of a sudden, that kid that's never, whose district doesn't have snow days or ski days, is already like disenfranchised. So we can't predict that, and we can't plan for that. But what we can plan for is the practice of the skill of taking text and analyzing it critically with a level of rigor that we can control for throughout the year.
I think this is amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm Lauren, and I are going to just slide in because it kind of naturally fits into the conversation that we're talking about, and that we're going to talk about IABs in English. But thank you, Dave, because you gave a lot of background. So now we're going to more so just go into the data of English. We kind of move some. Well, yeah, you can keep going. Next slide. So I'm going to have Lauren present on IAB data, and then I'm going to talk about another portion of our presentation.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Lauren Medlin. This is my first year as an administrator at Inglewood. I taught there previously for 4 years, and I was an instructional coach as well. So I know I've met some of you over the years, but just wanted to introduce myself to you.
Now she's our assistant principal.
So it's been fun. Good year. Learning a lot. Also, my first time presenting to the board. So Dave mentioned a lot already. So I'm just going to add ECMSI specifics and then just talk about the process in developing the trainings for teachers too, because that was really a valuable part of it all. So in the past, yes, we did IABs. To your question of, what's the norm for us? I first went to a training on them a few years ago, and I met a teacher there that is a teacher leader who, when I was going through the enhanced scoring for the first time, she told me that her whole school analyzes this regularly throughout the year, and I was super blown away by that because we don't usually get to that kind of stuff until, at this point, we never got to it until around May. So this year, we've started to mimic that, but in the past, we did not. So in 2017-18, we gave an IAB that it was similar to the one that we gave this year. It's the literary text IAB. So you can repeat that one for the students in the second semester, and it's just, of course, with fiction text, but the skills themselves are very similar, so you could see growth in students that way. So in 2017, we gave that test, and we gave it, I believe, in April, and our results are there at the top. You see that we had a lot of bubble students and not a lot of students that achieved above the standard. We also did not analyze the test as a whole or in departments ahead of time. The next year, so last year, we did a little bit better. We had a little bit more administration, but still not whole school. However, we did analyze and learn how to hand score the IB, because all of, well, not all of the IBs, but some of the IBs require teachers to go through and actually grade a constructive response before you can see the overall results. And that's really valuable learning for teachers because it requires them to calibrate. So they look at the CASP released responses of students, and they look at the scores that they gave the student response and compare it to the scores that they gave it. So we go through a calibration period as well, and that always leads to a ton of learning for teachers. So last year is the first year we did that in our humanities department. So we were able to adjust instruction at that point. However, as you see, we still didn't do it whole school. And I would say just the administration in general was very sporadic. So teachers were able to choose when they could do an IB, which IB they could do, and we never really had a whole unified force over them. So this year, this year, like Dave said, we changed that. And just also the backstory of how this all came around. In the summer, the RA leads and I and Danielle planned a series of PDs where we could teach the teachers how to administer the test. We had them, like Dave said, take the actual test, which was challenging and like led to a lot of emotion from teachers, really. And I think just helped them understand the experiences.
How'd they score?
And I think just even going through the system, like a lot of teachers were frustrated that they couldn't read the test on paper, that I didn't print it out for them. They really wanted me to stop and print out the test so that they could annotate. So we really tried to show the experience that our kids would have. So they, you know, they did well. But after that, we had them analyze the skill demands. And what we saw is that this test, although, you know, we could say what we will about standardized testing, it does require students to think critically and exhibit real-world skills that we do value as a school. And so it helped us tie our goal of literacy across the content areas with this terrible thing that we have to do at the end of the year and make it a little less terrible, hopefully.
Do all three grades take the test, right?
Yes. All three
the
grades.
Same test?
What we did in the fall is we had teachers all take the seventh grade one because it was the most interdisciplinary. It was a science text. However, all the grades took their own grade level since in middle school, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade all take the CASP test. So after we administered it, and I think just even in the administration itself, we shut down all the rest of our meetings that day, and the entire campus was doing IB, so it was a really high-quality test environment compared to previous years. After that, we divided up the scoring. We all calibrated. Geneva and I had tests that we were grading. So the whole school was really involved and aware of the rigor that was involved in this test, which was a really good process. So we did this in October, and as you see, our data is we outperformed the way that we did in March or in April of the previous year. So that's really great, and I think it has a lot to do with just the teacher prep. They were aware of the demands of the test, so they've tried to change their teaching based on that. So that was this fall.
And I think we also contributed to the testing environment, not only when it comes to admin and teachers, but also support staff from campus engineers, as well as campus aides. We found every single nook and cranny that we possibly can on campus to provide a positive test environment, especially for students who need accommodations. And then also the shout out to help desk for just always being there and helping us, making sure that the internet is running as quickly as possible. So all of that does matter.
So I think we made it also seem for teachers not just something that we were requiring them to do as like a, we need to, you know, check this box, but instead we value this as a learning process for us, and we're going to really take this data seriously and change things from it. So we'll set up a system that helps promote that. So that was in the fall. We did the reading informational text IEB, and just like the high school decided for the spring, we decided to, instead of doing whole school and ELA IEB, we decided to do the math performance task. And
that decision, it's really to connect our work with RA and with literacy across the content areas and show that that work we're doing, it doesn't just support the ELA teachers, it supports, all teachers on campus. So if you do look at the math performance test, the literacy demands are really quite rigorous. There's a lot of text that they have to sift through, a lot of charts and data and info that they have to piece together with questions that have multiple steps, multiple parts to them, questions that build upon each other. So we're really looking forward to doing that again in February. We'll be giving this. Also today, actually, that's a screenshot of our notes from a meeting I had with some math leaders on our campus. I'm trying to involve as many folks as I can, because I'm not really a math person. Also, I want to encourage this to be a team effort. So one of our teachers and my math coach and then Charity, our math specialist, will be facilitating the fall training and we'll follow the same protocol. The teachers will take the math test, which will be interesting and good.
Because I think Lauren highlighted that all teachers will be implementing this math test, just like even math teachers implemented the other IEP, yeah, the reading one. So.
Right, and we'll, every teacher on campus, we as well will grade the test and calibrate. Additionally, we will give teachers the option to do more IEBs. What's great about them is that they're focused on one particular target. So for example, a teacher could give an IEB that's just on editing for mechanics and grammar. If they did a unit on that and they really want to get data on just that particular topic. However, that will be to their discretion. We're going to focus our attention on these whole school ones so we can really dive deep into them.
Before we briefly transition to some celebrations, are there any particular questions on this?
Just a clarifying question. So the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade took the same
type of test.
But at their grade level.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. That's like so amazing. Like,
I'm excited.
Yeah. Really, all of you, like, it's so great. So exciting.
I'm really excited about it too. Honestly, normally when I would do a PD, I'd have a million things I would want to change for next time around. But when we planned it today, the process worked. The teachers gave great feedback on it, and the data shows that it worked as well. So, and I'm also just happy to be giving a PD about standardized testing that's not terrible. Yeah. So, anything else?
So we just want to briefly highlight a success that I know that the Left Board meeting, we invited everyone out to our Harvest Festival, and thank you, Anthony, for being able to attend. It was an amazing turnout. We had over 350 people come from parents, students, and community members, and parents who were even interested in applying to our school. So it was great. We had UCLA come out, and they were their dentist school and was able to provide free dental screenings. We had Connect a Credit Union come out and talk to parents about financial literacy, and also they had their ice cream truck up on the left. We had Feast come out. We had Bay Foundation come out. We're working with them, having this amazing grant that we're having for Table to Farm grant that we're working on with them. So we were just very excited about, this is about our 6th annual Harvest Fest, and every year it gets bigger and better and something that we're extremely proud of. So I just wanted to share a couple. Thank you for everyone who was able to attend. That's
what's happening in here. Thank you. If you guys want to leave at this point, you're welcome to leave. You're welcome to stay, but I just wanted to make it comfortable for anyone who needs to go.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to the development update. That's Julie, my personal vision.
Can I say one thing as Julie said? So one thing is Connecta. We recently opened an account at Connecta. They brought their ice cream truck to several of our events, and they gave gifts for our teachers recently as well. So it's kind of a developing relationship.
That's cool.
And Ken has been supportive of that as well. So.
Also, real quick, well done, Lauren, your first presentation.
Yes, great job.
everyone. So I'm here to do our fund development update. So again, a lot of these slides look very familiar. We're going with consistency here. And so the second slide just highlights, again, what our school side general fund fundraising goals are. And so I think one thing you'll notice, I don't think you'll represent in the last presentation, is that with the guidance of our finance committee, we now have also incorporated some school cycles for ECHS number 2, which I think we weren't thinking about last year, even though we've had some funding come in through. So you'll see that the school cycle has increased to about $852,000. This is what shows up in each school's LCAP fundraising plan. And then in terms of our development status report, I know it might be a little bit hard to read, and the link is down below if you wanted to see the breakdown. And so we've increased our fundraising goal this year to 2.1. And this is because, again, we're incorporating some additional funding for this year as well as next year for ECHS number 2. So specifically, for 1920, we added $320,000 into the general fund, which takes us to $910,000, and then $150,000 for future years in new initiatives. And again, this is anticipating additional setup costs as we move towards ECHS number 2. And so, next slide. And so, our progress so far is we have raised about almost 1.1. So, just about half, a little bit more than half of our goal. And so, again, a huge chunk of that is generally speaking for ECHS number 2. And so I was just talking to Farnaz about, whenever that we do decide to open, that goal still remains. Right? And so it just sort of maybe expands the timeline for us into $1 million of those dollars. And again, because it's the December update, just wanted to remind everyone about our year-end fundraising appeal. So we'll be sending out probably 2 communication blasts as well as a letter to our active donors towards the end of the year. One thing that we really want to try this year is actually have some touch points with our donors leading up to the year-end campaign. And so what I want to propose and what we probably will be rolling out is asking board members to call about 5 to 10 of our donors to, one, just show appreciation and gratitude and let them know that a field letter is ready, that we would love them to continue supporting us, and then to wish them happy holidays. So I do ask for a commitment roll that out, and I will follow up with all of you and give you the list of names and contact as well as the short scripts so that you can kind of just sit down in front of you and read through your scripts as you make your call. And for those who may have helped support us with our Giving Tuesday campaign, thank you so much. We really appreciate your support. And then, of course, as we wrap up 2019, we're halfway through our school year, so we still have tour dates that you can invite folks to, as well as a variety of
community school, community events. Any questions? Hi, Bobby, good to see you. Julie, this is a tremendous feat. I just want to recognize and appreciate what we're undertaking, what you're leading. And also, just to echo what she said, we would really appreciate it if you could make a phone call to
sure.
Behalf. When a board member calls and says they're a board member, it's 10 times more impactful. So that would be awesome.
So I'll send out that list by the middle of next week. So you can sort of build that into your timeline. Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, so next we have the financial update. Dorothy.
Okay, I'll start on slide 3. So this is a high level look at what has changed between the last event in So you can see the budget forecast and the actual month EDA for months 1 through 3. And we are trending a little bit lower. We just got P1, but I haven't looked at it yet. And so at the next board meeting, you'll see an adjustment for where we think P2 will be based on historical drafts between P1 and P2. So in terms of changes from the forecast, you'll see in each of the schools there are shifts in the CMO salaries. The reason why the high school has the biggest savings in the CMO salaries because they had the biggest percent of the student services administrator, and that position is no longer being filled as an employee. And then with Dave moving around, so that's why you see a shift for them, and then Regina's the opposite of that. And then for the high school, their biggest increase in expenses was with special ed. Just the way the expenses are trending this year, we added close to another $100,000 in expenses. For Gardena, we did drop the forecast again. Last month, we only dropped it by, I think, 3 or 4. And this month, we're dropping it by 10 students, just based on the actual trends of students. But the good news is, based on P1, I think we're keeping it close to where the current forecast already is. The next slide, so operating income fell by almost $70,000, really because of the loss of those 10 students. We did have some savings in salaries, but that's somewhat offset in substitutes because 2 teachers are on maternity leave, and that's why the substitutes went up. Is it 2? Mm-hmm. And then at Inglewood, slide 12, their ADA was pretty close for months 1 and 3, but it actually dropped in month 4, so we will be adjusting that the next board meeting, the next final meeting. And they didn't have that many changes in terms of their forecast. They had the shift in the CMO salaries, and the biggest change was really an instructional consultant, but that was really for the ACES grant, but we already adjusted the ACES grant up, so that was just a delay in timing in terms of matching the expenses.
ACES is after school.
Slide 16, our first slide on ECHS2. This is their budget for this year that only includes how they're spending the federal grant, and it's really, they're meant to zero out because they have to spend it in order to get reimbursed. The family and salaries. And the last slide is a look at the cash, which is nice that we all have it. Any questions?
The finance committee had asked questions about enrollment at Gardena, and we have plans to extend enrollment opportunities to a few more people off the wait list. We're getting close to that wait list being complete at this point because we have called quite a few people that are now based in another school and don't want to make the transition at this point. So we will be calling people on the Inglewood waiting list as well. Our hope is to get 4 additional students in the 6th grade and maybe 3 additional students in the 7th grade. The 8th grade is class that has the most gaps in students, but bringing students in the 8th grade last semester can be a really challenging
experience.
Recommendations?
You don't want
them. 8th graders? So that was just an update. We have a plan to try to get some more students, but we are still forecasting it to be lower than what we had projected.
I sent a 7th grader. Did a 7th grader enroll in the last 2 weeks? At Gardena.
At Gardena, if you want afterwards to tell me the name of the student, I can check. I know that there are 4 students who are set to start in January. I don't know if it's one of them.
Awesome. Okay.
They have been working on a better recruitment plan too
for next year.
Met with all the counselors from Long Hill yesterday. Lucy did a really nice presentation for them. The students, it was really nice.
Yeah, because I get a lot of parents that, you know, big schools are not good for them for whatever reason. And so those kids, you know, other than going home school, there's even some that, you know, we'll talk.
Thank you. Thank you, Dorothy.
Thank you,
Dorothy.
So I think we want to shift the agenda around a bit.
Yes, because Anthony's going to have to step away a little early. We thought we would do the
founding board members.
The votes on the items before he leaves, and then we'll do the benchmark chart and study session right after. So approve consent.
Yes, we're moving to the approve consent items A through I. Any discussions on that before we approve?
Did you approve the agenda with the changes when you made a motion to approve the agenda? Did you approve the agenda making a change
the
in order?
Order?
No. I would just reapprove it for Brana purposes if you're and take a vote just in case.
So
it needs
I have a motion to approve changing the agenda. Accommodate the board members.
The second motion?
Zena, aye.
Denise, aye.
Mark, aye.
Ben, aye.
Janina, aye.
Anthony, aye.
Right,
so be changing the agenda has been approved. Any questions or concerns regarding approving the consent items A through I or on the consent items A through I? I have a motion to approve consent items A through I.
I move to approve consent items A through I.
I have a second.
I second the motion.
Zena, aye. Denise, aye.
Mordecai, aye.
Janina, aye.
Anthony, aye. We have approved consent items A through I. So, moving on to action items. Action item A is to approve the submission of ECHS number 2 charter petition appeal to Los Angeles County Office of Education. Any questions, concerns, or discussion regarding action item A?
Share that. We're moving forward with the appeal process for the LAUSD denied petition. We expected that to happen. And we're moving up forward to appeal that decision to the county and following the protocol that they have online for how to move that appeal forward. One of the steps is to have the board approve that action and our moving that forward.
Anybody have any questions, comments regarding action item A?
Why was it denied?
Oh, thank you.
Location, is it the optimum?
Poor academic results.
It was for at LA Unified, the experience that we had is they were during the capacity interview, they had identified that we had submitted multiple petitions. And they were worried that we didn't really know the community in which we wanted to open for the stakeholders we wanted to serve. We shared the strategy that we had, that we only wanted to open one school, and that our students aren't tied to traditional district boundaries, but are kind of following the brand of ECS. And therefore, because of 1507 and the new legislation that you have to open in the district in which approves you, we wanted to choose the best location for our students given the facilities that are available, and there are limited facilities, and you can no longer temporarily locate someplace. So the best strategic move for us was to submit multiple petitions to be able to afford us the greatest choice in possible locations. And even though we explained that to them, it felt as if that they were seeking a reason to deny us and make a recommendation for denial, and so that's what happened. And we have been talking about that strategy with LACO, and we believe LACO understands the strategy. However, it's a little tricky because when we move the petitions for approval forward, they're only going to want to approve one of the petitions. And so
the facility issue is the biggest challenge for us, as always. And if we had a facility that was set, then we would know who to go to and then seek authorization. We would only describe one community that we plan to serve. But the reality is that we have to describe multiple communities in submitting three different petitions to three different.
What's still on the table? I know we were going to submit to LACO anyway, right?
You can't submit to LACO until you've submitted to the local district, been denied by the local district, and then you can take to LACO under appeal.
Is that a new thing?
It's not new. That's always been the way. You can only submit directly to LACO if you have a countywide charter. And ECS is not considered a countywide charter because we do not serve students throughout the county. We only serve students in multiple school districts in one little pocket of the county.
Okay. So we were always planning to submit to LACO, but I guess...
We always knew that we were likely to have to appeal to LACO.
So their objection to these multiple petitions, it was them and Sentinella and who else?
Inglewood.
Inglewood, we just presented in front of them last night, so they've not made a decision yet. And LAUSD has made the decision, so that allows us to then take it to LACO at this point.
So we're able to take the LACO before the other two denials, as long as one denies the LACO?
We can take any of the petitions that are denied to LACO. The reason why we're moving forward with LAUSD's petition is it's because most of our students live in LAUSD. If you take all 240 students from both Inglewood and Gardena, 108 of them live in LAUSD. 73 of them live in Inglewood. And then a speckling lives in Sentinella Valley School District. So the reason why that's the reason. If we were able to find a site adjacent to either one of those middle schools, that is where we would ideally open, because then the students that go 6 through 8 can easily move into, and then the remainder of the students from the other school site would have more seats available for them at the high school. Currently, only 25% of our middle school students from each of those schools are able to attend our high school to make up the 50% of the population of students at our high school. So by opening up a second high school, we free up additional spots for the other middle school. Does that make sense?
So we'll have more for you on this soon, but our hope is to take this to LACO and to seek their approval and be able to consider a facility that would be adjacent to our Gardena site.
So, and we submitted a petition, we only submitted a Prop 39 request for a co-location in LAUSD with 108 signatures of meaningfully interested students. And so, by law, LAUSD has to provide us with a co-located site. Now, whether or not they make us an offer that's close enough to our Gardena campus and to the community we want to serve, because sometimes they give us a community that's much further north or much further south. So they use their entire district when considering that, but
I represent Londo, but have you considered, as a temporary, you know, band-aid, I guess, but it does help in the long. Revising that so that more than 25% of the students from each school, each middle school can attend, and limit the number of Lawndale students.
So we through the process over the last number of years, the last time we went through a petition process with Lawndale, they had asked us to make sure that we save seats for Lawndale. And it was 50% that had to be inside the petition. And in this round, we preserve 50% for our middle school students. So now it's 50% Lawndale, 50% our middle school students.
Before it used to be 50% Lawndale, 50% lottery. So it could have been our middle school students or anybody else who had equal probability of getting those seats. So now we've increased the likelihood of our middle school students, but the Lawndale percentage has remained the same. And that was definitely a requirement in our petition process for UCHS when we went back recently, just last year.
So we were able to increase this year more ECMS students were able to attend ECHS this year than in the past. Still, number one reason cited by those that either didn't apply or applied and turned the seat down was distance at both sites.
So it's not really, there is no space, it's just hard to get in.
So there's some that turned down seats, but there's some that didn't even apply because of the distance.
Okay, so what do we need? We need a motion?
Yes.
I'll make a motion.
I want to point out one more thing, because a lot of times during the capacity interview, they ask board members if they were aware of some of the items that were in this element. Which is like that you're agreeing also that to the memorandum of understanding between us and LACO. Jeremiah, do you want to pop in and talk about those items?
Oh, yeah, sure. Just the items that are listed here on the agenda. The first one, LACO board policies and regulations. So the same board policies and regulations that we follow for the two middle schools. Same thing with the MOU. We just recently signed that MOU for ECMS Gardena. So it applies the same to this ECHS 2. And then the next three are related to the ECHS 2 petition. The petition as submitted to LA Unified, the budget, and then the Gardena renewal petition, which we recently had renewed by LACO, which is going to be very reflective of the ECHS 2 appeal. It's going to be very similar.
So essentially, when we submit this petition, the appeal to LACO, we have to tell them what in the petition that we submitted to LAUSD we want to change. And the only thing that we want to change of the petition that we submitted to LAUSD is we want to remove the district-required language that LAUSD requires us to have in there and replace it with the language that we currently have in our other petitions, which you've already approved. So it's just replacing their required language with our insurance requirements that we currently have and that already meets the standards that LACO likes it to meet. Thanks, Jeremy.
Yeah, I have a motion to approve the submission. I move that we approve submission of the HF2 charter petition to appeal to LACO.
Second.
Denise, aye.
Mark, aye.
Ken, aye.
Janina, aye.
Anthony, aye. So action item A has been approved.
We'll move on to action item B, approved fiscal year 2019 audit report. Any questions, concerns, or comments regarding fiscal year 2019 audit report?
Another clean audit, which we're proud of, and our hope is to have an audit committee who will review and have conversations about the audits more deeply going forward, and Kathy Kessia and Anthony have offered to serve on that committee as our board representatives, so that's wonderful. But we're proud of the audit, and I want to recognize Jeremiah David for his leadership in making this a very smooth and thoughtful and clean process, so thank you.
Thank you.
When do you anticipate
anticipate the starting their committees?
It should be late January or early February for the new bid cycle for the new auditors that we need to bid for.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments, or concerns before we motion to approve? So I have a motion to approve fiscal year 2019 audit report.
A motion to approve the audit report.
Second.
Second. Zena, aye. Denise, aye.
Mark, aye.
Ken, aye.
Janita, aye.
Anthony, aye. Action item B has been approved.
Thank you.
Awesome.
So now we're going to go to the CEO update, and we're going to take some time looking at the benchmark chart together before jumping into a five-year strategic plan.
You don't want to hang out there for a couple hours and grab my son too, do you?
I'll put my son in an Uber.
You can have my daughter
an extra day.
She's coming in tomorrow.
You know, I live. How's she doing?
She's great.
I want to hear more.
Yeah, sure.
It'll be the first Christmas I spend with my both children in 18 years.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Very exciting.
It'll be exciting. Yeah.
That's crazy.
It is a little crazy.
So with that, I wanted to take some time. You guys have the benchmark chart in front of you, and I want to go into it into some level of detail. And before we go into the second and third sections of our strategic plan, so we're going to start with the top section, which is the RA implementation fidelity. For the first 3 months of this year, we've really focused on the implementation of site visits to observe classes and to see RA practices in play. After that, hopefully we'll have some data to report on the fidelity of the implementation of RA. So right now it's really like, are we getting to classrooms? Are we observing whether or not teachers are doing this? Are we giving them feedback on what we observe? So at the three different school sites, you'll see that there's been some variation of implementation of the site visits, and some of it has had to do with recent transitions, but we're making progress. Then we go to the minor build in math, and on the minor build in math, you can see that we're providing NWEA math scores, and the percentage that are meeting college readiness benchmark of the 70th percent. I'm sorry, the first data point is the percent of students at or above the 50th percentile. So you'll see that at the high school, 45% of our students are at or above the 50th percentile, but the percent that are meeting the college readiness benchmark is significantly lower at all three places. So as you can see, math is something that we have begun to focus on and need to focus on more. And it's something that by having a math specialist who's been providing the supports that she's been providing at all the school sites and implementing a single type of curriculum, we're hoping to see gains in even this year. But this is the reason why this may become a focus for next year. The next areas are the things that we are tracking regularly for our dashboard. So if you guys were to go up on the California dashboards, they're now up and live for every school. And these are the things that all of our schools are held accountable for: attendance, suspensions, expulsion, chronic absenteeism, and exits. So as we look at attendance, this last month in November and December, associated with holidays every year, we do see a dip there, but you can see that we're dipping below the 97th percentile that we shoot for, especially in our budget, and all three sites. Ever so slightly in Gardena, but the enrollment numbers dip there, and that's why we saw such a big dip in the budget there. suspensions. We had two spurts of suspensions, one at Gardena and one at Inglewood. The assistant principal, the dean of student culture at both sites are very aware of our goals for keeping suspensions low. As you can see, last year there was a total of 14 at the high school, 12 at Gardena, and 14 at Inglewood. And our goal would be to not surpass those numbers if we can, or to even become lower than those numbers if possible. Chronic absenteeism, we were doing much better in October. The one, Gardena and Inglewood are actually doing better than last year. The high schools just went ever so slightly above last year's number. So if you were to hover on those, on the living document, you would see that we were at 4.8% last year in December. So chronic absenteeism goes up in December at the high school every year, but this is an area of concern that it went up even a little further. And then RA, we spent a good amount of time going over the IAB data and how we're doing and how we're tracking on that, but that's exactly where the data that they presented on lives on this benchmark chart. So any questions on this data thus far?
So I have a hard time knowing where we want to end, where we want to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be really helpful to have a column of kind of what's the target for each one of these. Like, is, you know, 41% good relative to where we would like it to be?
That's good feedback.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's challenging about that? So what we'll have to do is the column will have to change depending on whether it's IAB or NWEA or CAPS. Because our expectations on each of these tests are different because they track differently, as you guys heard earlier. And then attendance, the way that you guys have access to the living document of this, and the way that we track how this is different from prior years is that Robert has been putting comments into each cell when this number exceeds or is in line with or is significantly lower than prior years. So it's kind of a living document in that way.
So
right,
is that
now
what the red, yellow, green is in there?
That's what I'm trying to depict it with. So this is a stagnant version of that.
Right.
But in the living document, by hovering on any of the boxes, you can see the relative data to it.
Yeah, this one is a lot. But
I can share the living document with you right now if you want. But yes, I'll definitely put in that column in there and try to depict that.
Yeah, oh, I see. Because
what's
in
Board
on Track is just a PDF,
like
too, so it's not the actual document.
Exactly. So, like right now, if I hover on that, let's look at chronic absenteeism. In 18-19, it was 4.21. But in 18-19 at Gardena, it was 4.31, but this year it's 2.57. So that's where you have the historical data.
Yeah. Well, the green, yellow, red is helpful. Maybe there's a way to color code some of the other areas as well. Because there's IAB numbers, I don't know whether those should be celebrating or commemorating.
So the areas of the strategic analytics, since last time we focused on the strategic plan and our priority one and RA implementation and same-thing student outcomes goals for the first page of this, for this time our hope is to focus on the second goal, which is, if you click on to the second one, address inequities in achievement and enrollment. So that's depicted right here under closed gaps for student groups. And I'm going to come back to this. So that area where you see a lot of red are African American students, our students with disabilities, and our English learners. most part are performing significantly worse than our general student population. There's only one exception, which was in Gardena last year and in 2018, in English language arts, where African American students have access. So this is our second goal, which next year could become our singular priority, just because right now it's listed as our second goal. I don't want to de-emphasize the importance of this. To me, closing these gaps is critical to our existence and our mission statement and our values. So I want us to spend some time reviewing this section right here of our strategic plan based on these questions. So if you look at this plan right now, this is
I just have to ask a question about the students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Is it our expectation that we will also be able to close the gap in person?
It is our expectation that we will come much closer to closing the gap. For all students, yes. And what we're seeing right now for some of the student populations is the gap is significantly larger than it should be. So if you look in some years and in some places, the gap, so for example in 2017 in Gardena, there was a 10-point gap or there was a 14-point gap. And in some places now it's getting as high as 61% gap for students with disabilities. The size of that gap is relevant.
Right.
Do we think that we can completely? I think for African American students, there should not be a gap.
Right. Got it.
Any additional questions? So, right now, if you can take 5 minutes to review this section on your own independently. So we're on page 2, and we're on address inequities in achievement and enrollment. You're going to take 5 minutes to read this on your own, and then you're going to think and pair share with one person sitting next to you or two people sitting next to you. Are these the right actions? Given the desire to focus, can we cut out any of these actions? Are the measures on the benchmark chart the right ones? Like what should we be assessing differently? See whether or not we're making success in these areas.
Are we looking at 2021, or are we looking at just 2018 to 19 happened?
So 2018 to 19 was a reporting out on what we had accomplished in 18-19.
Right.
2019-20, this is what our goals are for achieving this year. Okay. These are 2021 is for next year, and then 21 through 23 are separate.
Right, but which do you want us to focus on?
So
year
all
one
of
or year?
All of
them. Okay.
So just read the whole thing.
Okay.
And review it, and then possibly what you might say is this action that you have for year three is something you absolutely have to do this year. Like, that's the conversation we want you guys to be pushing us on. Any other questions before we break to read? Thank you.
Thank you.
my hand. Your hand, how much more time you need?
Thank you.
So if we could pair share in response to these questions on the screen. Are these the right actions? Are they the right measures? Is there something we should be taking off or something we should be adding?
Well, we all can say we're anti-bias, you know, we all say, but I think a lot of us don't have it because that we have a disadvantage.
Sure.
I think that may not be. Whereas anti-bias is like, why am I doing this? I'm already here.
Right. You could take it as like a, oh, we need to increase the population, or you could take it as like, we need to fill the school.
So right.
What's the goal? What's
right.
The primary goal?
Right.
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 That's what I see when I
just to increase the population. Population.
We're just having kind of a brainstorming conversation here.
There's a specific thing issue with parents. Should be done along the way, not part of the show.
there's a lot that it's good to say.
I think this the other thing is all the different things.
Student services, that's been my concern for the long term. What would that person do? And then there's the dean of students.
I think that, honestly, and then the number of this
matters. But you know, this is a like
That's the challenge of having also so few students.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think the movie,
yeah, that's true.
I think last year in our junior year, we only had
Don't you have to have like at least 15 kids?
Yes, to report on a subgroup, but this isn't about a subgroup. This is our internal goal. So we probably would not report on that subgroup because it was such a small number that year.
This just tells me you're being hard on yourself. If one student accounts for this 16%, you know,
it's not one student.
But I'm saying the number is so small that's really tough. It's not an organizational aspect necessarily. Because if it's 50 students, I would say, why? But if it's only 5, it's like.
Exactly. It's too small for them to even be successful.
It's also such a different cohort each time, because this it's such a small group, and then it's such a different cohort because it's such a small group. But it's not a reason to not pay attention to it.
You guys ready to talk as a group?
Yeah,
let's talk as a group. So, I think we're such a small group, and you guys, I welcome you to join our conversation about this if you're interested. So we would love to have you up here with us if you're comfortable and want to, but no pressure. Thank you for being here. I know you guys got here at like 6 in the morning. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Your 12-hour shift is over.
Let's go ahead and jump right in because we're a small group. What stands out for you? If you want, I can go through and say what are the things we've already done under 18, under 19, 20, if that's helpful. We have hired Beth as the principal coach. We have budgeted site-specific anti-bias training, and two of our sites have begun the anti-bias training. We hired and onboarded a student services administrator, but that person left, so they went back to their prior role. So that's a pain point for us right now because we're trying to appropriately staff and support student services.
And what's
special education?
Oh, that's for special ed.
The primary purpose of that position was to focus on for this year and next year special education, and then ideally, if they had a background in EL, they could possibly support strategies in EL as well.
Then so under is that person more of like a curriculum director then?
That would be like having a Danielle type figure who oversees special education at all three school sites and ensures that our strategies and our data management systems and everything are in alignment. We hired someone
and her perception of what the role would be versus what it was were very different. So,
why do you think that happened?
I think the reality of it is that we need on-site, more on-site coordination, so that if we wanted to have a role like that, it would truly be leading and directing. But this person would then end up getting involved in the day-to-day stuff at school sites, and that was not tempting for them. He was also not the right person, but it's also a really hard position to hire.
So, like, what?
Not the right time for the right person. I think she is the right person.
Did we learn anything from that?
She's still stayed on with us as a consultant and has been helping us, and she's been great. But what have we learned from it? We're still actively learning from it. It's all pretty recent. So. Deans of student culture all participated in restorative justice training alongside Dave Trejo. Dave plans to bring everyone again together again, since they did the training in October or November, to sort of think about our practices and our policies and see what we can refine to better support all students.
Who are the deans?
So Danny Chrysalis is a dean of student culture. That is a new role that we introduced last year in our budget at Inglewood. We have Tarvia Royale, who's the dean of student culture at Gardena, and Lucy Banuelos is the assistant principal in charge of counseling and social emotional wellness at the high school. So she's the one who's presented to us every year on college acceptance rates. So that is already underway, and they're working to do that. And we have Robert, who does our data management, has really been working on the data, developing a data monitoring tracking system, and looking for very specific elements that can really, like a system that just automatically gets our attention when a student is on the, is not performing, so that we can, instead of having to seek out and look for the data, when a student is not performing, what are the triggers that should lead to staff intervention, counseling support, teacher intervention, and other actions. We have not done, we've done a lot of what we're saying under enrollment and recruitment on an ad hoc basis. We did implement Apply LA, which is a web-based application process for charter schools that makes it so that no one can claim that we showed any kind of favoritism in our process. Mm-hmm. Everything goes on to the web. Everything is done through a lottery system, and nobody can say, oh, well, they took my application. And like, it really makes it so that it's very clean, but also more people can gain access to our school, because if they, right now it's not benefiting us in that sense, because there aren't enough people accessing the system. It's only in year two. Last year there were 20 schools on it. This year there's 100. But the goal is that if a lot of families are going on to the website to sign on to Apply LA, they'll learn more about charter school options that way. And we need to do a better job of continuing to reinforce the mission statement. So there's some things that we've made progress on, and there's things that... the thing that I would change from this is that I think we need to partner with a organization that focuses on helping schools to be better aligned with supporting the needs of African American students and addresses bias. I want us to have like an organizational assessment and think of a strategy.
Say that again. We need to.
So like we've been talking to. The National Equity Project. We've talked to Pedro Noguera and his project out of UCLA, and we talked to this program out of West Ed that does this, and our hope is to have a partner that can come in and sort of like you would have an HR assessment or a special ed assessment. I want an assessment of our schools and see what are we doing wrong, and how do we get better.
It would seem like that's almost like step one.
Yeah, so that's something that we have already like done. So like we reached out to them, and the feedback that we received from the three people that I, two of the three people that I called, is that it would make most sense to wait until Danielle comes back from maternity leave in March so that she's there as a partner in this process. And that definitely makes sense to me.
Yeah, because that'll inform your next couple of years.
So like conducting an audit.
Mm-hmm. An audit, an assessment, like a deep dive into our structures and systems to see what's wrong.
Right, and having...
Why are we having those?
Having an external, new eyes, fresh eyes on it.
So that's where we're at with this. What do you guys, what stood out for you? I mean, I heard something here about, sounds like a lot of conceptual ideas, but nothing that's really action-oriented, which aligns with what I'm struggling with. So
right.
please go ahead and share.
Well, I mean, I like what you were just talking about. I think that this whole school is moving towards much, much more evidence-based actions and strategies, and we're still struggling to find out what it is that's working and not working. And I think sort of collecting that those kinds of data up front would really be powerful. I mean, and I'm sure these organizations also have thoughts on what works and what doesn't work in situations like ours. So
that's one thing that I'm going to, since this is a living document and I can add to it, I'm going to add that to it. And since we are doing it, are there any other items that stand out for you as things?
There was one, and I don't know if I'm just not reading it clearly, is to develop a network-wide student recruitment strategies to increase enrollment of African-American students and other underrepresented student groups. And I guess my question is, we talked about this earlier about how we're requesting a certain percentage of students at the high school, 50% from, Longdale and so forth. Like, are we looking at what the actual population is? Like, maybe there isn't as high a percentage of African American students, and maybe that's why it's not as much, and why are we not just trying to improve the success rate of the African American population that we already have, or are we trying to change the population of what our school makeup is? So that's how I'm reading that. I wasn't quite clear.
I think that's a really good issue to point out, and I think we are trying to change the population that we serve. The reason being that in the places where we see that we have a larger number of African-American students, like better representation, they do better. And so what is the right number of a student group in order to make, and what, regularly when you speak with African-American students at our high school right now, where there's the lowest population in some grades, they'll tell you that they feel isolated, they don't feel like there's enough representation, they wish there were more people who looked like them. We have lower percentages of African-American students than any of the neighboring districts that we serve.
We're charged to mirror the neighboring districts.
And we're not mirroring them. So Inglewood, Hawthorne have higher percentages of African-American students.
Because we were thinking Gardena that our school represents
right now, Gardena is getting close to representing the community, but not quite. And Lawndale does not.
Do you know your percentage at Lawndale?
Of African American? It's around 9%.
Nine?
Yeah.
And isn't that sort of
close
to
ours? Close to it. But we have one school that where it's about 25% because they're all concentrated in.
Which school is it?
FDR, Roosevelt.
But here's I mean, you bring up another interesting point, though, in year one, which may or may not tie to this discussion, and that is how do students self-report on race?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you are in a blended community, some students may be Black and Hispanic mix, and which one are they putting down if they have to choose one or the other?
Well, they're self reporting everywhere, so
I know.
But I think when you walk on the campus, it's obvious.
Right.
I think, whether they're identifying one way or another, but the fact that visibly you don't know, you kind of have to find them.
I guess I just have that question is why they feel as a minority group that they don't do as well, because they feel isolated. Because, you know, my kids went to a school where they were a minority, and that didn't seem to affect how they did in school. So I'm just wondering.
There's all sorts of.
I'm just wondering why it affects this population.
There's all sorts of racial stereotypes that might impact that as well. Mm-hmm. So you have to think about the fact that their experience is different than your students.
Right.
And
could
so,
be. And I just put in that question.
Yeah.
So many
dominant family structures.
But there's all, I mean, there's clearly a lot of data.
That
shows that is true. Mm-hmm.
That if they have an African American teacher, they're significantly more likely to
and
succeed.
Principal.
If they have a principal,
yeah,
they're far more likely
right.
to
yeah.
succeed. And then if they have a certain percentage, if there's a certain number of students that makes them not feel isolated, then they're more likely to succeed. Those are three data points that are.
I mean, so
available.
For example, in my experience when I walked onto the Gardena campus, they had implemented the Student Black Alliance group.
Mm-hmm.
Lunch. And my question to them was, you know, what do you like about your program? What do you like about this? Because it's a volunteer.
Right.
You know? Instead of going to hang out and have lunch with your other peers, you know, you're out here. And I was surprised at how mature these eighth graders were articulating. I feel safe. This is a platform where I'm being heard, you know, because, again, they're mixed peers.
Mm-hmm. They also come predominantly from struggling situations, whereas your kids are not coming. Your kids are coming from a position of dominance and privilege, you know, whereas they're not.
And again, transportation. I'm trying to think. Yeah, that area where FDR is, that's the closest, you know, large African American population. It's, you know, and that. I always use William Green and FDR to signify the two most distant points in our district.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is almost where William Green is. So it is very, it's the
so
farthest community.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not saying there aren't any African-American families in between, but there aren't pockets.
It's not a cluster. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's
so I think
people like to be with people that are like them, right?
Yeah.
And when you feel like you don't have anybody that is like you, you feel isolated and not a part of something. And when there's, on top of that, stereotypes and bias that's happening subconsciously amongst the population of youngsters that are way less savvy than adults, it just makes it that much harder. The experience that our kids are feeling microaggressions that are, you know, unconsciously or consciously happening in their everyday life is difficult. And so you want to be with someone who understands that experience and is because then that population, that subgroup can succeed differently because they have a support team and structure within them. I mean, even if you look at our success rate in getting kids into colleges, I often wonder when I look at the data, what is causing the tick up in the most recent years? Has it been the success of the overall team? Is it the makeup of the counselors that are supporting our students? Just the fact that we have a variety of different subgroups represented on our counseling team, is that helping our kids succeed? Because they have role models that are there supporting them and understanding where their unique needs are coming from, it's gotta be supportive.
I think it's because we have seen them.
Yeah.
Well, I find it fascinating because I've been looking at this lately that there's two issues at play. There's the humans are tribalistic in nature. We seek out community. We seek out similarity. We seek out groups. That's what gives us comfort, that closeness, that togetherness. And then at the same time, those groups can transform into being isolated, exclusive, bias, prejudice. And so how do you balance? It's a very delicate balance between allowing the space for people to form their little tribes, but also to be open to that idea of belonging and togetherness that will promote open mindsets and not like total exclusive or exclusivity. But it's a delicate balance because we're prone to groups, right? So you want to naturally feel like you belong. So you don't want to have like one black student. You don't want to have one woman on a board. You don't want to have it's everywhere, right? You don't want to have like one person in a position who's the minority. But then at the same time, you don't want it to go to an extreme where then that group become the out group, the minority group, becomes so exclusive in their nature that it actually counteracts what you're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't focused on the fact that our population doesn't mirror the surrounding population. It is our mission to serve all the students in our district, and that should clearly be a goal, is to put that front and center. And if in achieving that, we help to alleviate some of the isolation and performance gaps, and that's great. I mean, we certainly should be doing that.
We should. Absolutely. And then maybe we can be more specific as to a goal or a percentage that we want to achieve so that we can reflect.
So that we can recognize success. But a point also that's really important for us to be aware of is that with these success rates, I don't know how comfortable I feel really going out and seeking the population. We need to address the gaps in our instruction and the gaps in our system and structure that is leading to students to have such significantly lower outcomes than other students. So,
can I ask a question? So you have a lot of bias prevention, bias training, which is great. Is that for the kids too, or is that just for the staff? Do the kids get instruction on inherent bias and everything?
The curriculum that I've observed implemented at our high school by our teachers is consistently helping students to raise awareness of these issues. I saw you wanted to chime in.
There's the ethnic studies course in ninth grade that addresses social justice through a personal lens to be able to like assess microaggressions and what is systemic racism and what does that look like, and that's built in. Although that's under attack in the state of California because there's a counter argument that folks are making that it produces liberals, not people that are open minded, and so because of that there are zeros. There's a group like you can look it up and there's a pushback.
Because there was an article that was pro us, and then the same day the same negative article.
Yeah, and then there's like I think what we want to be cognizant of is like what does our staff look like in terms of does our staff reflect the community and how is that being prioritized.
Right.
So that when you walk onto campus, you don't have to feel like such a subgroup. And it goes up to our board. Like, I mean, I think it's cognizant and important to note that we're talking about recruiting more black families and there's not a single black voice today.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we have to recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're making a lot of assumptions that I think we need to be careful with how we word them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm feeling defensive over here and I just want us to be very careful with how we word things, because we want to avoid general statements about they, because that is a form of othering, which is, we have people within our group, within our staff, within our teaching staff, within our students, within our families, that if we really want this research, then like let's be intentional about the creation of ways to solicit that feedback, so it's not just a survey, so that we're pulling that in, because
qualitative, like a
we have people within. It's not like we don't have Black or African American families or staff members. But as we delve deep into this, we risk continuing the systemic idea of we're going to do things for you instead of with you.
Thank you.
And so I just want to see the cognizant of that.
I was feeling a little defensive too moments ago, and I think it's because just in the experience of my own daughter, from her personal experience of thinking about where to go to high school, she chose Redondo specifically because there were more people of color at Redondo, because she's often questioning where she is in her own space. And there was an instance in Hermosa Beach where a teacher had talked about homelessness and then said, well, none of you have that problem. And for those of you who know me well, know that Joe was homeless at a period of time. And that has become an asset for her, mm-hmm. as opposed to a deficit. We were at that meeting yesterday and someone said deficit. Mm-hmm. That struck a chord too, because I think kids come with all these various backgrounds and they're assets because they see the world differently. Mm-hmm. And we have to constantly remind ourselves of that. And when you see and have a different experience, you want to be, I know Taylor wants to be able to communicate with other people that have had similar experiences to her, because they can jive. Her best friend right now has, you know, a dad that's had an experience that is a similar experience as her. So they have this bond now that is like, they don't even have to talk about it because it's understood. And that's so special. And when you're a part of a subgroup that doesn't, then you may, I don't know how you feel, but that's, you know, part of what we have to ask for our kids, like, how do we get that to go away? And I think that's
one thing that just is an initiative that's being revisited at the high school. Every advisory has gotten dehumanizing language and slurs, specific racial slurs, lessons from our counselors in response to the data that our Black and African American students have communicated via surveys, in which they have communicated that they do not want to be the only ones that are standing up for the appropriate language in all the learning spaces. They don't want staff members to walk by, look over, and hear something and say, oh, there are two Black students there, so they must be giving permission. They want the staff members to turn around and stop and say, you can't use that word, you can't use this, and we're teaching them to be advocates, and it's having an immediate
impact. Can you say that again? I just want to understand. So what
the students are communicating, what they're asking for, they're asking for the adults on campus to be cognizant of the Black experience, so that when the language is being, the language that Black students can use or is being adopted by other students, that they get stopped, that they get called on it, that they are not, that burden of redirecting other Latino or white students should not fall only on Black staff and Black students.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they want, the students are advocating for that. Lacey, one of our counselors, just presented at PV on Monday. And so one of the things that we're presenting at the next board meeting, I wanted to have it ready for this one, but with everything that was going on, it's not ready. We want to make an amendment to the handbook this year, mid-year, so that it has to go home with the students, that specifies what our process is and our discipline response that's restorative, but adaptive to how we will respond to dehumanizing language.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important for our students to see that they spoke up and that it will get put in the handbook mid-year, but we also have to follow through
mm-hmm.
on it.
So do you have that list or document or
of
in a
what?
Summary form of the language that the students have asked us to be more attentive to? And to
we don't have like a list of the words. We've defined what dehumanizing language is through university terms, as well as like easier to understand terms, like Brené Brown has terms related to how you other someone. And so those presentations have been put out there.
Can we see? Can we have a copy of that presentation?
Yeah, absolutely. That's
maybe
that's
the board wants a presentation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that'd be great.
Maybe we can.
Well, and for sure send it around to us. I mean, we should be on board with it too.
Right, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, what you mentioned, working with parents, not for them, or FDR, going back to that school again, they started a parent, African-American-owned parent group. And believe me, the first meeting, I went to the first, it was extremely, it was very contentious, because parents, African-American parents are always, let's face it, we're afraid of them. And when I say we educators, or at least the educators here, because it, like it was just shared, we're not used to some of their nuances and in their culture. For example, they tend to talk louder than we're.
But I think that's a general.
Culture.
But
no,
that's making
but,
me uncomfortable
no,
too,
not,
because
not,
it's.
Not,
it's
no.
Latina, I've been told that too.
Yeah,
so
but if you've ever gone. I have a childhood friend, I used to go to Thanksgiving dinner, and you could not hear, I mean, they're just talking. What I'm trying to get at is, when African-American parents are talking to a teacher about a concern, they raise their voice, but they're not being hostile, they're not angry, but the first assumption we make is, excuse me, ma'am, can you please lower your voice? You're yelling. I'm not yelling at you. Yes, you are. Well, no, I'm not. And not, now all of a sudden, this principal riled up this parent. Now the parent is yelling at the top of their lung. But it all became because we already have these assumptions, implicit
right.
bias
right.
that this is an angry parent because their child is a misbehavior. So I think those things need to be addressed. And they're difficult, you know, because again, I'm Latino, and in my culture, you could call my parent and you could say, your son just hit another girl. If you do the same exact thing to an African-American family, hello, Ms. Johnson, your son just hit the child. All of a sudden, you're going to be a problem, because in my culture, you don't need to connect with me for my parent to allow you to discipline my child. African-American culture, if we don't connect with them first, like, hey, good morning, how are you? Thank you for being here. You just lost them. And
so
I think those
I think,
are some of the things.
I think we're getting into a dangerous like territory of anecdotal evidence and general statements. And Mr. Roy, I have a lot of respect for you and a lot of gratitude. But I think what we're getting into, I think the more important substantive thing that you're alluding to is that there are very real cultural norms and differences that we have to get to understand and be open to. I think the burden of any organization, whether it's a district or a charter school, is when soliciting feedback from stakeholders, whether it's students, staff, or families, is to be able to extract, to ignore the tone if necessary, and extract the message. And that's the burden of leadership, of effective leadership. I've certainly received feedback from teachers or students in the past that has not been the greatest, or delivered in the most professional terms. And that's not their burden. They're communicating something that needs to be heard and addressed. And so if we need to ensure that everyone feels heard, then that needs to be done in a variety of a modality of ways, so that we're not speaking for them, because we continue going back to it. And I'm like, frankly, pretty uncomfortable with the way that we're generalizing the African-American population of it. And I know it's not malintended, but it's bordering on inappropriate, and I need to be, I need to state it, because if not, I'm not being true to myself or to the community that we serve, because there are families of all races that come in with various decibels.
Have you ever seen me defend my daughter? I'm yelling.
But based on our outcomes, based just solely empirically on our outcomes, there are subgroups within those that have more justification to absolutely be angry if we don't do anything.
Dave, I just want to say here, because I think it takes bravery to say this, and I really appreciate you. And I think that
I think that it is critical for us to have more African-American representation on our board. I think it is critical for us all to go through that some level of training and engagement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that this is what, these generalizations are what our students are experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whether or not they're well-intended, generalizations hurt people.
That was my point. That was exactly my point, because just like I started, the way that first meeting started, it started very wrong. Started just kind of like what we're doing right now. And that's not why our parents go there. But now, fast forward a year and a half after, it's extremely collaborative. The parents are leading it. You know, the people that were speaking for them are no longer part of the picture. The parents are doing all the speaking. So it's kind of, you need to go through that in order to get to the real message and the real work.
And I think
work.
You're right. I think the reality of it is that we are at that contentious moment as an organization, because how can you look at this? How can we look at this and sleep, honestly, right? Like, how can we say that we're educating kids when we have gaps like this?
Right. Right.
And I just, again, really want to appreciate you, Dave. Thank you so much. And I really want us to get...
I want to thank Dave, too, and I want to ask a question of him. That is, do you think the organization is putting an appropriate level of priority and resources against this issue?
I think our biggest obstacle to achieving our equity goals is sometimes operational bandwidth. We have so many wonderful positions within a supportive organization that remain vacant. Part of it is we're competing with district salaries that are being bumped up, and part of it is we have like shortcomings in terms of staffing in the HR department, where we just don't have people to physically make the calls on a daily basis. We have an African-American student advocate role at the high school that has been vacant for 3 or 4 months, despite a lot of candidates, because there's special education positions that have been deemed more high priority, and justifiably so. Like, there's people have to make choices, right? And so part of it is sometimes things happen, and when you run a small ship, if we're not planning for things to go wrong, when things go wrong, other things get put off to the side. And so, like, operationally, like, I think that's where we have to do some introspection to decide whether or not we have the appropriate bandwidth, and if we don't, do we need to reallocate existing resources, or do we need to bring more people in temporarily to meet those goals? Because for people to want those positions and not even be interviewed yet, and I'll take some responsibility for it, but we all can list the variety of reasons why we're not there yet. But as a small organization, there's overlap and Venn diagram in job duty performance. And when you run low on that, then we're not setting ourselves up to meet those equity goals, because had we hired an African American support coordinator or student coordinator 3 months ago, those students would be 90 days more supported by someone that looks like them, whose only agenda is to increase those outcomes, who can meet and say, oh, I have a meeting with X person, they're absolutely going to ask me about this, and they're backed by the organization and the principal, I know that I have to meet those goals. And so when you stretch people thin, equity gaps increase.
To that, I'll just say also that we are in an organization that's going through change management. And when you go through change management, you lose people. We've lost people, and it's been painful and hard, and we've lost people in HR,
mm-hmm.
and we've lost people in facilities, and we've lost leadership, and we're going through that actively right now, but I'm optimistic that we're going to get there. The reality that you face, though, when you lose a person in HR is that that's the person who could be hiring all these roles,
mm-hmm.
but it's hard to hire them, the right person back in that role simultaneously. So it's like one of those. So I just want to say you're right. You're absolutely right. And I'm not saying all this to be defensive, but it's the moment that we're in is a moment of change management. And
Right. Just a couple things come to mind. Perhaps you or someone out, someone in the room knows of the avenue that we should be going down to find people of color for these positions, because I think what happens is if you put a post out on Indeed, you're going to get a majority of white people applying.
To give credit to the HR team, though, of the positions that were hired last year, which were quite a few, 63% of them were African, 7% were people of color. So they definitely emphasized hiring people who represent the students that we serve. And as a result, we saw a significant increase in representation, because especially at one school site where 70% turned over last year, that's vividly visible.
I've been at the hiring fairs with the current HR staff, and there's a concerted effort for that. What there hasn't been the opportunity for is for someone like our Sarah Jamison to go to HBCUs and travel and build those relationships,
right,
because she has to hire all these positions. And so if you've ever seen the Eisenhower matrix for decision-making, like, we constantly are in the urgent eclipsing the important.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that's where operationally, academically, we've tried to get away from that and have a singular focus of reading apprenticeship to allow us to be living in the important quadrant of the Eisenhower matrix. But operationally, we continue to live in the urgent eclipse and the important. And so day to day, more time passes without those relationships being built, so that when someone meets someone at Howard University that wants to travel to LA, it's like, hey, let me connect you with someone. They they prioritize Howard applicants.
That's
a part. And there's a lot of things down to go with. And I certainly am not the only person that harbors these ideas. It's just operationally, like, these decisions, these conversations have been had without us present operationally at cabinet or at home office meetings, I'm sure.
And then the other thing I want to support is that having contention in discussions is a good thing, not a bad thing. It's uncomfortable, and not everyone knows how to handle it necessarily, but the more we do it and the more we invite it in a respectful way and the more we teach each other how to have that kind of conflict and discussion that is healthy and respectful but also is earnest and uncomfortable at times, I think the better off we're going to be, because this is the moment to do that. And if we can't figure out how to do it in here, if we can't figure out how to, you know, then we're not going to be able to figure out how to do it out there.
Yeah, I think Jim Collins says that any organization that goes from good to great engages in contentious debate where not everyone agrees, or people are learning from each other. And as you increase the diversity of voices, the potential for that to increase is there. But that's a value. It's a value add.
Yeah, but we have to learn. We're not used to it, and that might, I don't know if that might come from like the white culture. Dominance, where, you know, the white culture is like, follow my instruction, very like assembly line, industrial revolutionary, like, it's hierarchical, follow my instructions, don't talk back, you know, whatever. And so I think we don't know how to engage in this kind of discourse. I mean, we as a society don't know how to engage in this discourse, and we need to all learn. So I think that should be part of like any kind of training that happens, like how do we.
Yeah, I don't think it's not just it's also part of a privileged culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right,
or dominant culture, because, you know, if you go outside of America, you can look at it as dominant culture. In Asia, it's going to be, you know, the Asian privileged culture, right? So it's not even white culture; it's dominant culture, privilege.
Sorry to sidetrack. I just wanted to make sure that the voices of those that are not in the room are considered and invited into the room more often, because with enough time, we can certainly put together focus groups or invite our African-American staff members to talk about their experience as staff members or, you know, under their their voices in a multiple, through multiple modalities of gathering that feedback. I just want to make sure that as we gather that feedback, that we know that we have the bandwidth to act on it, because there are few things more damaging than soliciting feedback, getting thoughtful responses, and not acting on it. That will lead to a lack of trust.
We did a couple years ago, we did, Danielle reminded me of this, a people of color workshop only, and she said it was a very difficult thing for her to make happen, even though I was supportive of it and helped her make it happen. It was because the amount of blowback that she got from the white community, white teaching community on our campuses, there was a lot of frustration that it was, that there was some separation of it. And so how do we make it? I'm using that as, because it's hard to do.
And just a reminder of the process for coming up with this goal particularly was that it did come up at cabinet. We did draft this at cabinet, and then equity and diversity did spend some time reviewing this set of goals as well. So it's not something that was drafted in some room without participation, but it is something that we need to come back to with that committee, and we need to come back to refine again.
So it sounds like we need to find more opportunities of collaboration, even if it's fraught with some contention, which I think was your point in the beginning. Your point in the beginning was like something started off contentious, and now it's ended in a good collaboration across the different groups.
Because you have to go through, you have to go through that. You have to go through the pain. You have to go through, why are you calling me? Why now? You know, and eventually it becomes very extremely beneficial, and that's what's happening.
So, what a perfect segue to our next board meeting, Dave. Just so you know, our next board meeting is going to be on operations.
I appreciate it. Sorry, I was in Chicago most of the week. I missed my son.
All right.
and my wife.
She counts too.
Anthony, do you have any words of wisdom for us? Are you still there?
Oh, I'm still here. Yeah, I wish I was there in your business, but I'm not in the air. No, I'm in the Air Force, so that's probably not
okay. So,
well, I just think that, you know, your notion of bringing in an outside group to help gather some data and,
there's another program at LMU.
Just started. The one that just started?
I think gentleman's last name is Washington. They do the same thing though. Implicit bias. Mike Smith at Dominguez Hill, the Male Success Alliance. That's what we're using with the parent group at FDR.
I think we're at a very systemic time in our culture, and ECS is a microcosm of that. So, we have the opportunity to pave some paths here.
I was going to add to that the other one, since my participation in this has been to really have an understanding of how problems
we get funding for equity and diversity and inclusion type work?
We dedicated funding to it this year.
But do we get funding? Like, are there grants out there?
We have sought grants for them, but we've not received any of the grants that we've sought this year.
Hmm.
So I don't know if we have this going through.
No, but there's funding specifically to support the improvement of subgroups that are underperforming.
And have we gone after any of those? Or
it's automatic as part of LCAP.
Oh.
So that part of it is automatic. So there's funding baked into the LCAP.
But there aren't private foundations?
There are private foundations that fund it. And we've gone out for one or two in the last year and some that I've been here. But we did not receive those grants. The one thing that we did receive this last year was a grant from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative that's going to fund the professional development that we paid for this year out of our general funds for reading apprenticeships. So next year it's going to fund that.
Mm.
So that gives us a little bit of wiggle room to reallocate funding for professional development solely associated with this. We're seeking funding. We're looking at those grants and trying to find ways to seek additional funding. We're also saying that you don't necessarily need to receive a grant in order to allocate funding to this, and that we should.
Sure, sure. No, but I mean, I'm just saying it would help.
But I think to date that's been the conversation. Oh, we need to seek funding, but we can
they should be mutually exclusive.
That we can reallocate to this because it's a priority, and what we're doing is not enough. So with that, I think that we have a lot to think about and come back to. I welcome any feedback that you guys have, anything you want from us to support you in this conversation, and we'll come back together and continue the conversation on the plan. But with that, we generally break for appreciations at this point.
I appreciate just how much we've moved to, or how much we've been able to devote in our meetings to really meaningful conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we used to talk about what color we're going to paint the walls. Very meaningful and that stretch us and the organization. So I appreciate that.
Well, it's interesting to come back a few years later because I think you appreciate the resiliency of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different, very, very different.
No, don't feel on the spot.
Oh, no, I mean, I just appreciate being part of this conversation. I think we all can learn from each other, and it's not just one party or another that needs to learn. We all need to learn together.
Appreciate Allison and her work.
Oh my gosh, we didn't even
talk.
Oh,
yeah.
Our hero.
Congratulations.
That was pretty impressive. Congratulations.
Thanks. Thank you. It was quite an experience because it wasn't a fundraising thing, and a lot of times they give you get awards for fundraising, and so it was special. I think the most special part of it was Taylor was able to be there. And I just want to remind everybody, like, this wasn't me. This was the work of the entire organization. And I got this KCET award where I was identified as a local hero.
Oh, okay.
And they did a little film on me, and then there was an award ceremony, and there was a lot of networking that was possible. But I really think that, you know, the success of this organization, as Jorge pointed out, is a result of the hard work of so many people and the resilience of the organization to keep coming back to fight the good struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate Farnaz and her ability to create spaces where this kind of conversation can happen unapologetically, and the push to be data-driven to all of you, to Ken, who has pushed us to get there, and to Farnaz, mm-hmm. who has created a system in which that might be able to work for ECS over time, which I couldn't figure out how to do. Like, it's pretty cool, huh? So.
I appreciate Jeremiah for all the work that he does.
Yeah, the
linchpin. I appreciate Anthony for staying on the phone with us, even though he's off picking up his son. And this conversation wasn't an easy one, but it's an important one, and it's probably central to everything that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And you need more.
And we need to have more of it. And we need to have more of the right people here to participate in it.
We need someone who's an expert in this on our board, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to...
It's too bad Kathy wasn't here, too.
I know. Mm-hmm. That I definitely...
Yeah. I would have liked her perspective.
Mm-hmm. Especially as a parent.
Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm.
I want to appreciate David for his participation and passion in the petition last night and the previous petitions. He's done a phenomenal job, so just appreciation of David.
And his voice tonight, which was really critical and helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thank you all, and with that, can somebody make a motion to adjourn the meeting?
A motion to adjourn the meeting?
May I have a second?
Second motion.
Denise, I.
Mark, I.
Ken,
I. Thank you.
Anthony, I.
Thank you, Anthony.
All right.
I don't actually think. Do you have to vote? Anthony can vote.
Oh, okay.
He's participating as a member. Good night, everyone. His location hasn't been identified.